Today, the second commandment. The new law in Texas is that in every classroom, a suitable copy of the Ten Commandments will be distributed, will be displayed. And today, number two, thou shalt not make to thyself any graven images. Well, literally, a graven image is an idol or representation of a deity that is carved from materials like wood or stone, carved from materials like wood or stone to be used as an object of worship. The word graven stems from an Old English term meaning to carve or sculpt, differentiating it from a molten image, which is poured or cast from melted metal. The phrase is famously known from the King James Version of the Bible. It's the second of the Ten Commandments. Okay. I hope I'm not in trouble. While the literal translation simply means a carved figure, in practice and historical context, it strictly refers to a physical object that is revered, venerated, or worshipped as a representation of a god. Now, I find this part fascinating. The word graven stems from an Old English term meaning to carve or sculpt, differentiating it from a molten image, which is poured or cast from melted metal. Because this means, if I'm reading it correctly, all three of these graven images are bad. But this molten one is not. Well, maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself. For some of you, it's been a long time since Sunday school, so let me remind you about the golden calf. It's a story we love to tell about the dangers of graven images and of idols. Now, I asked you to remember some details from last week. The Israelites left Egypt, where they had been enslaved, and they came to the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of Mount Sinai. And the Lord called to Moses from the mountain and said, "If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession." And then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to come to you in a dense cloud so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." And there was a lot of up and down the mountain, and then God spoke the Ten Commandments. And then for another dozen chapters, God elaborates on the law and adds commandments about building a tabernacle and ordaining priests and things like that. And then at the end of Exodus 31, it says this: when God finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, he gave him the two tablets of the covenant, tablets of stone, written with the finger of God. And now we go to chapter 32. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron, his brother, and said to him, "Come make gods for us, who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Remember this from last week. The Lord said, "I am going to come to you, Moses, in a dense cloud so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." So now the people are saying, "Come, make gods for us. As for this Moses, we don't know what's become of him. He's been gone a long time. As for this man, Moses, who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring them to me." So all the people took off the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. Aaron took these from them, formed them in a mold, and cast an image of a calf. He said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a festival to the Lord." They rose early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought sacrifices of well-being, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to revel. And God saw what they were doing, and it made God mad. But Moses implored God and said, "Oh Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Turn from your fierce wrath, change your mind, and do not bring disaster on these people." And the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he planned to bring on his people. So then Moses turned and went down from the mountain, carrying the two tablets of the covenant in his hands, tablets that were written on both sides, written on the front and on the back. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved upon the tablets. As soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets from his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made, burned it with fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the people drink it. Then there's a lot of blaming and shaming. Then a Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf the one that Aaron had made. All right. "Make us a god to go before us," the people demanded. Today, I want us to push aside all that we've heard before about these verses, and I want us to ponder a new question, not just about idols, but this question. What were the people really asking for when they confronted Aaron? Many translations of this story begin with the people saying something like this to Aaron: "Come, make gods for us who shall go before us." And we go, what? Gods? Plural? Have these people so quickly forgotten that they are the children of God, the God who freed them from the captivity of Egypt and asked nothing more of them than to paint the doorstops and the lintels with a lamb's blood? It might seem that they have. But remember all that we talked about last week and how some names for God are rendered both plural and singular. So don't get distracted by that detail. The notes in my study Bible admit that many commentators choose the plural in these verses, "make us gods." But they then go on to state that it's more likely that what the people actually wanted was not other gods, but rather something that would serve as a new means of securing God's presence. In other words, the people wanted a tangible something that could assure them that God was still with them. And this interpretation makes perfect sense if you remember that the whole reason for the people's panic is that Moses, we forget this, the one who has represented God's presence to them, the one God wanted them to trust, has left them and been gone for 40 days. It's possible that the people didn't want many gods or even any god, but they wanted reassurance of the presence of the God of Israel. Now you can follow me, right? Think about it. The people of Israel were homeless, wandering the desert, uncertain of tomorrow. They'd been abandoned by their spiritual leader, and they were afraid that God had left them as well. And they just wanted proof, I think, that God was still with them. Now, have you ever been there? Ever been desperate to know that God has not run away from you? That you're not alone? Ever felt the need for reassurance that God is with you? Ever been afraid, lost, anxious, lonely? My answers to those questions are yes, 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 and yes. Has that ever happened to you? It happened to King David, a man after God's own heart. Yet even so, in Psalm 13, David wrote, "How long, O God, will you forget me? How long, O God, will you hide your face from me?" It happened to Mother Teresa. In Mother Teresa's letter to Reverend Michael Vanderpeet in 1979, she wrote these words, "Jesus has a very special love for you, Michael. As for me, the silence and the emptiness is so great that I look and do not see, listen, and do not hear." Much of her writing suggests that for the vast majority of her life, Mother Teresa, the very picture of Christ-likeness for many of us, was uncertain of God's love for her and uncertain of God's presence. Why does this happen? Why do we sometimes find ourselves wandering in the desert, lost, lonely, angry, frightened, and alone, while God, if indeed there is a God, is off on the mountaintop with favorites like Moses? It's not a particularly comforting thought, but John J. McNeil, in his book Taking a Chance on God, says that we ourselves put up barriers between us and God. McNeil regularly spent an hour every morning in prayer, but he says, "The truth is, I sat there with my list and I had a great resistance to simply feeling the presence of God." And he began to sense that though God might want to have an intimate, direct, personal relationship with him, God might be tapping at the door, McNeil kept throwing up his own roadblocks. He says those roadblocks were always the same: anger, fear, and guilt. So my question, isn't it possible that the people of Israel who were demanding signs of God's presence were likewise experiencing anger, fear, and guilt? They were angry at Moses for deserting them. And they were afraid. They didn't have food. They didn't have water. They didn't know what the next step of the plan was. And you know there was more than enough guilt to go around. I don't want to talk too much this morning about the idols that we make when we're in the wilderness. We make a lot of idols, though. Sometimes the idols are our religious laws and religious tenets. We put them in places of honor and demand everyone else adhere to them. If we can point millions of school children in the direction of morality and what we call right teaching, then we won't owe such a penalty for our own immorality. If all of you do as God says, then it won't matter so much if I cheat a little. It's a great deflection. But that's not what I really want to talk about. I want to talk about us right here. Right here in the church, trying to be a loving community. Here are a quick few bullet points. This is like what AI puts at the beginning of all your articles now and ruins the whole thing for you. 1, don't put your faith in a Moses. Save your faith for God. Two, balance compassion for people who have made gods of the laws with challenging them to do better. Challenge them to find the compassion behind the commandments. When the law is glorified, bring up the Beatitudes. Oh, and this is a good one. Don't be seduced by things written in stone. Is God still listening? Is God still speaking? I absolutely believe so. And I'm leery of those who believe that God hasn't had anything new to say to people in 2,000 years. And research your objections. Don't simply say that posting the Ten Commandments violates this or violates that or makes you feel this. Find out if it does indeed violate other certain laws. And if it does, on what grounds? And ask the tough questions. For me, one of the questions always is there any such thing as teaching without transmitting some degree of personal integrity, morality, or their opposites? Let's make sure we learn something from this whole argument. I want to end today by telling you about a theory that I'll call the hole in the bucket theory. I didn't think of it, and I've read many different versions of it, but for today, here's what I want you to know about the hole in the bucket theory. There are people who have holes in their buckets. The holes are all kinds of things that we've already been talking about this morning. The holes are things like anger, fear, and guilt. The holes are our insecurities and our childhood wounds. The holes are our unmet needs and often our shame. The people of Israel had all those holes in their buckets, and on top of it, they were lost and homeless and hungry and had no means of self-governance, no control. And they could not be sure of God's loving presence. Their buckets were leaking out all over, and they were acting out all over. Here's what I want to say. We all have holes in our buckets. I have holes in my bucket, and look at me, I've got a really big bucket with lots of room for holes. Some people have holes in their professional buckets, and they take credit for other people's work, and they make excuses and cut corners. Some people have holes in their parenting buckets, and their very best instincts leak right out of them, along with their self-doubts and their fear and their anger and all the fear and the anger and the insecurity replaces them. Churches are full of people with holes in our buckets. We in churches memorize the Bible and declare grace and forgiveness from God and then don't turn right around and show it to others. The children this morning are studying that parable where the man is forgiven a big debt. And what does he do? Remember? He runs out to collect the little debts that other people owe him. His bucket should have been full, full of gratitude and hope for a new future, but instead it was empty. We in churches cling to positions and programs and traditions, hoping they'll bring us safety and stability. And even when we finally realize they are great stones bringing us down, it's hard to admit that we were short-sighted. Instead, we hope others will have short memories. What we desperately need to know is that we're lovable. And we'd really like for people to love us. People to love us. And our parents and brothers and aunts and cousins and teachers and colleagues and partners to love us. But all the people we want to love us, all the people we need to love us, are just like us. And with all our holes in all our buckets, we often end up disappointing each other. And this is important. That's when we must turn back to the God whose presence we desperately need. The God whose love we need. The God who believes in us, even in our humanity, who values us, who first loves us and always forgives us. If we don't start from there, our churches, our beloved communities will be failed experiments. Because people who allow themselves to be taken over by the nature of Christ can love imperfectly, but we just try and try again. People who allow themselves to see the face of God not in statues or coins or trophies or steeples, but rather in the faces of those around them, are constantly surrounded by the presence of God. Whatever it takes to feel the presence of God, do that. I'll leave you with one of my favorite stories. Anne Lamott wrote in Traveling Mercies about her journey to find a church home and about her journey to begin to accept and believe in God's love for her. And after weeks of hovering in the doorway of a certain church and leaving before the sermon even started, she found herself finally sitting through the sermon week after week. She writes, "I had no big theological thoughts, but I had discovered that if I said hello to God, I could feel God say hello back. It was like being in a relationship with Casper the Friendly Ghost. Sometimes I wadded up a Kleenex and held it tightly in one fist so that it felt like I was walking hand in hand with him." Y'all, that's what I'm talking about. We all need to feel that something is coming back to us when we say hello to God. I would prefer you try a Kleenex rather than a golden calf. But I'm not here to criticize. Sometimes it takes what it takes. Amen.